how do you do business with the Department of Transportation? I've spent the last 2.5 years concerned with just that problem. I don't want to bore you too much with history, but I will tell you a little bit about how this center came about, because it really is true. We learned at the center how to do business with the Department of Transportation. We were the Electronics Research Center of NASA. This center was put together at a time, wasn't quite the heyday of NASA, but it was at a time when the budget had gone from $2 million to $3 million to $4 million, headed towards $5 million, and the optimists thought it was going up forever, like $10, $15 billion. In 1964, the Congress authorized the development of this center. It was going to be kind of an instant center. In a couple of years, it was going to be 2,000 people, $65 million worth of buildings, 30 acres of redeveloped land in Cambridge. Well, after the land had been taken, but before the buildings were built, the handwriting was on the wall that the NASA budget wasn't going that far. In fact, it would probably level out at $5 billion or so. That's one thing that profoundly affected the growth of the center. Another thing was that somebody stumbled into the sudden realization that the second letter in NASA stands for aeronautics. And during the exciting decade of space exploration, people kind of forgot that. So as the newest center, I was given the chore of developing some new aeronautics capability for NASA. So although our title was Electronics Research Center, 3 years ago, we had the second highest percentage of aeronautics work of any of the NASA centers. The history of the center took on a new meaning entirely about 3 years ago. We were just about ready to move into the center. Tom Payne, the administrator of NASA, came up and made the first use of our auditorium. We assembled the people in the auditorium, and he announced that the center was to be closed. That was in December, 3 years ago. And in the next few months, we had the experience that other people have gone through, except that I think ours was a little exaggerated. The first thing that happened is for one day, all the senators and congressmen screamed to high heaven that you can't do this to us. They do that for exactly 24 hours, regardless of whether they're Democrats or Republicans. Then the Chamber of Commerce took over and said that this is the worst thing that's happened to New England since the closing of the shoe industry, which is a slight exaggeration. And that's usually the end of it. But fortunately, some people who felt more strongly about the capability of the center kept up the hue and cry, and it went on and on and on and on. The reason the center was started as the Department of Transportation Center had nothing to do with you've got to use this capability. It had nothing to do with politics in the normal sense of the word. What we had to do was produce at the same time evidence that the Department of Transportation had been planning to build an R&D center sometime, namely about now, and it would cost $75 to $100 million. And here was a capability which was very similar to that described, available for nothing. In short, the way to do it, if you want to convert something, is don't say it's very capable and you find a use for it. Produce the use and then let people discover that the capability is available. At dinner, I was telling some stories about my old mentor, Dutch Kindleberger. Most of his stories require a little censoring, but I think this one doesn't. Someone once asked him, Dutch, how is it that you had the P-51 ready when it was needed, the F-86 ready when it was needed, the F-100 ready when it was needed? How come you got the first missile contract? How come you built a division which knew how to build rocket engines before people knew they needed them? Why is it, Dutch, that over and over and over again you can pull a rabbit out of the hat? And he says, well, I'll tell you what I've learned. If you want to pull a rabbit out of the hat, the first thing you got to do is put it in. In March, we got the word from the president that the center was to be established as the Department of Transportation Center. When we closed, we had 850 people, over half of them electronics people. another quarter aeronautics people, and the other quarter miscellaneous. When we opened, as a Department of Transportation, we opened with 400 people. Next point, how do you convert aerospace engineers and electronics engineers to the mysterious world of transportation? Well, I'm a complete rebel on that subject, and I think there's been an awful lot of wasted time talking about retraining engineers. It gives you some kind of a feeling there's something unwashed about an aerospace engineer, and you've got to come back, go back and kind of give him a bath and send him back through college and teach him something. It's an absolute bunch of nonsense. Our people got their conversion between 1 minute before midnight on June 30th and 1 minute after midnight on July 1st, as far as their technical ability is concerned. I've told this story. I told this story in the presence of some of my division chiefs, and I pointed at one, and I said, now, Fred here, for example, he does the same work he used to do. He simply reads different journals. And I was thinking at the level of Aviation Week versus Railway Age. Well, he's a technical guy, and he just said, I'm sorry to correct you. I read the same journal, because he reads journals on instrumentation. And that doesn't change, regardless of how you apply it. Over and over again, I could talk all evening about the fact that the technical guy who's well-trained and really working as an engineer, not in one of these fringe things that the engineering departments in aerospace build up to such a huge extent during their heyday, but anyone who's worked as an engineer can find that his talents are needed immediately in transportation. And it's incredible how true this turned out to be. Now, electronics. A great deal of transportation is electronics, but we were to be the broad scope, complete R&D arm of DOT. So naturally, in the last 3 years, we've added many other talents to our people. We've added a great many more mechanical engineers and civil engineers and more aeronautical engineers, program management type people, and so forth. One more interesting thing, when we started looking at our own resumes at the time of our conversion, when we were a little self-conscious about the name electronics, we found that well over half of our top management in the electronics organization were masquerading as electronics people. They'd really started out as aerodynamicists or physicists or chemists or civil engineers or something or other. I still have people approach me for a job, and they start telling me about all their great electronics experience and try and cover up the fact that they started out life as a mechanical engineer. So I kind of tell them that I'd like them to forget about that. You know, of course, there was a period there when electronics was an extremely popular area, and that's why people, of course, emphasize their electronics background. The center is at this point, the one general broad scope R&D center for the Department of Transportation. Now, the Department of Transportation is a conglomerate. Hopefully will grow more. It started as a conglomerate, and it will grow more in the direction of a unified intermodal organization. It consists of many separate administrations. The FAA, the Federal Rail Administration, the National Highway Administration, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the Urban Mass Transit Administration, the Coast Guard. And last but not least, the St. Lawrence Waterways. Now this is certainly a broad group of people to be associated with. It is organized with the Secretary of Transportation, an Undersecretary, and several Assistant Secretaries. The work we do for this organization is we do work for each of those administrations and also for the Office of the Secretary. The Office of the Secretary funds work which is either intermodal, namely crossing the boundaries between these various modes of transportation, or is something off in the future, or something which requires investigation so that policy can be made. Most of you, I guess, are familiar with government budgeting, and you hear about the budget cycle, and it's 3 years long. You decide what you're going to do, and you talk about it for a year, and then you put it together in a preliminary plan, and you pass it around your department, and then you finally take it to the Office of Management and Budget, and they massage it for 9 or 10 months, and finally some decisions are made, and it goes to Congress, and Congress agrees or disagrees, sometimes within 3 months and sometimes within 15 months. So a three-year cycle is not an exaggeration at all. Can you imagine trying to start an independent government organization where on March 29th you're told to go and on July 1st you have to have a working organization? The way we did it was we invented a new system, very new. No one had ever tried it before, just like a business. We got contracts with the administrations. We got the money in our bank. We added it all together, took the overhead off the top, and charged each person for the direct labor and contract and materials associated with it. The only thing we didn't have was an incentive contract. Or maybe we did in a strange sort of way. Our incentive was, how do you get accepted in a new organization when your entrance is, at best, a shotgun wedding? Jack Schaefer, the head of the FAA, is approached by the undersecretary, who says, Jack, this thing that I have in my hand's a gun, and it's pointed right at your temple, and there's something I'd like to tell you. I'd like you to give the Transportation System Center $5 million, and you and they figure out what to do with it. And furthermore, those 100 people you were going to hire in your R&D organization, you can't have them because they're going to hire them up there. This, any of you even vaguely associated with marketing might guess that this is kind of a hard way to start out life with a new customer. Some combination of the kind of guys they are in the FAA and the kind of capability that we had and the true need that there was for somebody to get going resulted in what to me was kind of a minor miracle. The $5 million shotgun wedding of the first year turned into a voluntary $10 million wedding the second year and maybe $14 or $15 million the third year. My people look at that, incidentally, and they say, gee whiz, we're a success. We started out, our overall budget, incidentally, was $18 million the first year, and it's around $50 this year. So people say, gee whiz, what a big success. And I caution them. I say, no, it's not success. Not in the real sense of the word. It's something pretty good. What it is acceptance. You've gone from just being newcomers, new boys on the block, interlopers, people who've stolen the budget and stolen the people, to where people have faith in you and look to you to help in the future. But let's not start bragging about success because we haven't been around long enough to point to much real success. The mode of operation of the center up until now has been more patterned over the NASA mode of operation than, say, the Air Force or the Army or the Bureau of Standards or any of the other government laboratories that I can think of. It's more patterned on the idea that there's a job to be done and a certain amount of money to spend to do it. And the attempt is, albeit not always perfect in execution, but the attempt is to use that money, that source of energy, to get the biggest job done. And it might be, in certain specific cases, that the best way to do it is to do it all in-house. I can give you some examples of that later. You don't do it in-house because you're smarter, and you don't do it in-house because there's something special about a guy called a government service. You do it in-house because it may be, say, that you want to do some research which will allow you to write a specification to put out an industry that would be very bad to ask someone in industry to do, because by writing that specification, he might disqualify himself. There are very various and sundry reasons why you want to do certain things completely in-house. But they're not the reasons that some of the arsenals were set up, where you just decide that you're going to do it in-house, period. There are some jobs, very few, that are the other extreme, handled where one man may just turn around and hand some money to either a university or someone in industry. Rather, the bulk of the idea in general is to divide this up, to do enough work in-house so you can do a better job of managing the contract which you let in industry. Now, we had to feel our way in this area with our new customers in DOT. They didn't understand this. When they gave us some money to do something, they expected us to do it ourselves. And when we first started talking about passing some of it through to industry, it was easy to see why, because of their past operation, that they'd misunderstand this. They'd say, well, why should I give you some money? If all you're going to do is put some overhead on it and hand it off to somebody else, I can do that myself. Furthermore, it's bad enough that you've got overhead on your operation. I can just hire, if I could only hire somebody, I wouldn't have to give them any overhead. So we had kind of this mixed emotions on how we could be used. But that's evolved too. 25% of our money went out to industry, and a small amount of that to universities the first year. 50% the second year. 75% this year. And I'd say 75% is probably a pretty good number if we continue to do the kind of business that we're doing now. So far, I've been talking about R&D in a sense that most of us understand it. R&D is hardware. It's the work you do to finally build some hardware. But to just start opening up a little how the vistas of transportation have changed, how transportation has changed our vistas. R&D to transportation people doesn't mean things that are hardware. It doesn't mean things that are technical. R&D also covers things that are social and economic. And some of these people get very upset if we talk about R&D as though that's something we know because we have a BS degree, and they don't know about it because they have a BA degree. What we've begun to learn, we're beginning to learn. In fact, we're learning it at a very accelerated rate, is that transportation, different from what most of us are used to, in transportation, the inputs and outputs of the system are at least as important as the technical problem in the middle. For example, the moon project. The input was one man saying, we're going to put two men on the moon and bring them back in this decade. And that was approved by the country, which it was. It was approved by Congress. When that was approved by Congress, that's an extremely simple input. I'll talk a little more about how simple it is. But my gosh, that's a simple input. Two men on the moon, bring them back again. It's a goal that's can't be misunderstood. You can't argue about it. You can say, don't do it, but you can't vary it. You can't say 1 3/4 men, or you can't say 95% of the way to the moon. It's very simple. The output's very simple. They pick up a bag of rocks and come home and say, here. And then you can debate about how valuable that is or not, but the output's extremely simple. Now, when you start talking about putting a BART system in San Francisco, the easiest thing by far is to build the device and put some rails down and buy a computer and hook it up. That's the easiest thing of all. The thing that's difficult is the demand, an analysis of the demand to build such a thing and an analysis of the impact of building it. And it becomes more and more apparent that that's the situation. You cannot work in a vacuum. You just simply can't say, well, here's a nice piece of stuff, now you find out a use for it. It's terribly difficult, even without thinking about the political complications. The fact that instead of dealing with the President of the United States or the Air Force or something simple like that, you're dealing with 200 million people and their elected, appointed, and you name it, representatives. You're talking about cities and counties and local transit administrations and states and regions and all kinds of things like that. But even if you weren't, even if you were talking about a very simple political structure, still the decisions of what to do and where to do them and when to do them are really the most important inputs, and not how to do it. The how to do it comes relatively easy. So as we began to discover this, we discovered that if we were going to really help the Department of Transportation, we better stop thinking of ourselves as a technical R&D organization. Think of ourselves as an R&D organization. We had, over the past 3 years, set ourselves up in a kind of classic matrix organization. We had an advanced development organization, which we call Systems Concepts, and we have new names for everything. Chief scientists are now called science advisors to the president or to the director. Advanced development's called Systems Concepts, Program Management's called Systems Development, the Engineering Department's called Technology, but If you have a translation guide, you find that we were set up in the way you would think, with an advanced group, a program management group, and an engineering group. Working in a true matrix way, the projects that were big enough would have a program manager, project manager, program manager, and he would get his help from the technology organization. So the matrix would work. If someone comes to our center and asks for help or advice, if he wants to know about a particular PRT system, he'll go to the PRT program manager and say, "Tell me how it works and what are the technical problems associated with it." If he wants to know about all forms of transportation that use a linear induction motor, you'll go to the technology people and you'll find the expert in linear induction motors, just as you'd expect from your own background. In the systems concept organization, we have, over the past 3 years, in a very, very modest way, started looking at impacts and economics and the social effects of things. For example, just a real trivial one in a way, but show you how you get started in things. When two airlines want to merge, they wave their arms around and talk about the effect this is going to have on people and the money it's going to save and et cetera. We thought this was a good place to cut our teeth, so we've been kind of behind-the-scenes experts in putting computers to work to play the what-if game there. What would happen if Western and American merged? What would it do to the route structure, et cetera, and to the economics of the situation? Well, without going into more detail, 15 or 20 little projects like that is what we've done up till now. But what we've got now, as a result of some great study at the center and in headquarters under the leadership of Secretary Volpe and Undersecretary Beggs, we've got an expanded charter. I almost said new charter, and that wouldn't be correct, but an expanded charter to really see if we can cover this whole area, the soft sciences as well as the what we call the regular sciences. So we've been hiring economists, urban planners, psychologists or two, and some people who started out life being systems analysts worrying about hardware who are now analysts worrying about urban impact. We're right at this time when the whole government is certainly under the very strictest implication of cutbacks. Before the president made a speech about cutting back here and there, it's perfectly obvious that the administration wants to get the size of the federal family down a bit. We went from 400, I might say, to 580 in the first year, and then for a year and a half after that, while our budget tripled, we haven't had any new people. But just very recently, we've been authorized to increase our strength almost 10% at a time when there's no other increases going on whatsoever. So it's more of this acceptance that the center can perform a function for DOT, which is badly needed. Now, how do you do business with a DOT? Well, the important thing here is, I can tell you a little about that, but much more important is to see if I can explain to you how the customer for airplanes, Air Force, Navy, a few airlines, the customer for spacecraft was NASA. The customer for transportation is those 200 million people. We're not going to buy transportation, even if it's federal money. The way the route of it is, you give a grant to the mayor of Oshkosh, and he matches that with a small amount of his funds, and gets some advice from various and sundry people, and goes and buys something. So he's the customer. He's the guy you're going to have to sell. What we're trying to do, and I think the way we're going, we'll certainly be able to make a big step in that direction, is to provide that mayor with a place where he can go and get the benefit of past experiences all over the country, get the benefit of the technical investigations made either at the center or under the center's direction, And he can go to one place and say, okay, how much does this PRT system cost? What's the effect of it going to be on my community? What's the cost of it going to be? What's the ridership going to be? And if we've been able to do our job properly, we won't turn to like the Bureau of Standards, you know, here's my barometer, please check it. But what we'll do is we'll say, okay, send your guy in here. We got a software package that you can use, and we'll show him how to use it. We've run a study on the impact of BART in San Francisco, and we'll give you the output of that and also the algorithms that you can use yourself. Well, you send your planner in here, and we'll let him talk to our planners who've talked to the other planners who've made the mistakes. This sounds all soft science, and of course it's one of the very important things, but let me give you another sample. Everybody in the country's got the problem of knowing what are the use of the roads in the city. No city has the vaguest idea. Your city hasn't got the vaguest idea how you get to work. It's just terrible. The data is just missing. Every once in a while, they spend a few million dollars running a traffic count. That means you stand out at the street corner and see how many cars go by that corner. But there isn't any process of saying, this man started in Nutley and drove here and then went through the tunnel and went so-and-so, and multiply that by the other million people so you really know where traffic's going. What is the use of outfits like that? Okay, just the other day in my office, this subject came up, and I'm not going to go into any detail on it now, but I just decided now there's something for the federal government to do. Boston can't afford to spend $20 million to do it. And then if Boston could, then take another 200 outfits, and if each one of them tried to figure out how to solve this problem, there go your $1 billion. So that's the kind of job the feds should do for the local people, not go out and tell them how to, in detail, how to operate their transit system, not buy them streetcars and ship them to them, but be a place where the information on how you figure out what you need is available. Now, those of you, most of you here, know full well what Langley Field did for the aircraft industry. I've been involved and been in industry and been in government. I've talked to an awful lot of people about government organizations, but I've never seen one that got more praise and less of anything else than Langley Field did in the early days of the development of the aircraft industry. You know, we started out flat in the water in World War I. We had the lousiest aircraft industry in the world. And from there on, we moved to going into World War II with the best in the world. And one of the things that was done was just as simple as this. Not everybody in those starving days after World War I could afford to build a wind tunnel. In fact, darn few of them could. So the feds built one. And they didn't use it to invent a better airplane than Douglas or Rube Fleet or somebody. They used it to make very fundamental investigations of different airfoil shapes and different engine cowlings and different landing gear configurations and so forth. They used federal money to do things which have to be done, and to do it in an efficient way. And the resentment that some people had for the early days against some of the Army arsenals or some of the Navy attempts at doing things themselves, they just weren't there, because these facilities were built for the aircraft industry. Insofar as it makes sense, we're trying to move in that direction. I'll give you another very different example. The Federal Rail Administration threw a little hunk of dough at us and said, okay, we've arranged to use a hunk of rural highway in Maine. It goes through typical town, by a typical church, by a hospital, by a school. It does all the things that roads do. Now, why don't you put a bunch of coils of wire in the ground, hook them up to computers, and design a system to tell people how to pass cars? Well, that was fine. That was 2 years ago. Just they were doing their share of trying to help us find something to do. That has evolved in our shop to something that physically looks the same, but the purpose is very different. We got the coils of wire under the roads. We've got the computers. But next week, 2 weeks from now, I'm going to a meeting of the National State Highway Officials Engineering Planning Branch. Because I told them the Langley story 6 months ago, and they've been figuring out what they want us to do with their laboratory that we're building up in Maine. It stopped being a couple of bright guys in my place are going to invent a system and go out there and test it. to we're going to provide a facility where when we understand what the problems that the various state highway officials see are the more important ones, then we'll put that on our facility there. Okay, how do you sell something to the Department of Transportation? Well, in the short range, you can sell your ability to help us do these things. And we've got $20 or $30 million worth of contracts with a whole variety of people. And the business is done just like everything else. Your marketing people know what it is. It's all in business, commerce, daily, and so forth. The deeper thinkers in your company, I think, should be careful that they don't fall into the old Defense Department idea, I'll buy my way into a contract because of the big production follow-on. Now, this, of course, worked for some companies and drove other companies into bankruptcy. But here, I think you got to be a little more subtle. If you do anything like that, you'd say, I want to get in this business so that I learn enough so that when I go talk to the mayor of Los Angeles, he's going to listen to me, because that's where the money's finally going to come. There just aren't going to be any, even in the FAA, which is the one kind of exception to this, where the government is largely its own customer. Except for that, all of this stuff, by far and above, the money's going to come from the local communities. And people who want to get into that business have got to establish a reputation, a national reputation, with the local people who are going to buy these things. I was telling about the Matrix organization earlier, thinking for the moment about this, how the center hopefully will look in 5 years. Now, instead of coming in and saying, how do all linear induction motors work, and going to technology, and how does this particular PRT system work, and going to the program manager, I hope they'll go to a program manager on PRT and say, tell me about what happens if I put a PRT system in my city. And this man will tell them about the demand analysis, the technology, the cost, the immediate cost, the write-off cost, the ridership, the effect on environment, the whole schmear of his specialty, PRT. Then they can go over to systems concept and say, tell us which of all the modes of transportation have the following characteristics and demand and the following characteristics and impact. So you see, this matrix thing will work again, hopefully. If you want to know something of a general nature, you go into the big organization. If you want to know everything about one particular thing, you go talk to the program manager. I hadn't been the new director of the new Transportation System Center more than 8 hours before I was on TV getting asked the famous question. The famous question, of course, is, if you can go to the moon, why can't you? And then you fill it in. In my case, why can't you make the damn MBTA work? And why can't you get me downtown? And why don't the buses work better? And why don't? The biggest difference between going to the moon and all these other things that are bothering people is the great difficulty in establishing the goal. And I mean establishing it so you understand what it is, and then establishing it so it stays a goal. Two meanings of the word establish. Determine the goal and then establish it so it stays put. I think one of the most marvelous things the American people ever did in their own marvelous, confused way, with their own marvelous, confused form of government, is to stick to that goal of going to the moon through 3 administrations. Almost impossible. We find that in general you can't stick to anything more than 2 years because you get a new House of Representatives every 2 years. So the fact that somehow or other that goal was established. The goal is a simple, simple, simple goal. I made a reference to it earlier. When you say go to the moon and come back, you can't argue about going partway. When you turn to transportation and say, it is our goal to have a better transportation system, you're right in the soup. You're much worse off than you were when you just said 250,000 miles, because what is better? One guy thinks it's better if he can drive his car to work, and another one thinks it's better if he doesn't have to drive his car to work, and et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera. The technology itself, you people know, I'm sure everybody in a room had something to do with going to the moon, and it was exceedingly difficult. It's the most difficult technical challenge in the history of man, by far, by orders of magnitude. Everybody knew it was crazy. Somebody asked me about the Beacon Report. That the Beacon Report said, let's fix up the air traffic control system. And we went to the moon, came home, and are wrapping up the program before we've got the beacon thing really implemented. We've got it started now. But this terribly, tremendously difficult technical thing was accomplished because the goal was clear and the nation had guts enough to go through with it. Now, when we move to transportation, we've just got to realize that we've got to be much more thoughtful, much more subtle. We got to work with the problem a whale of a lot more. And these inputs and outputs that I'm talking about, then you can see why I'm saying they assume such importance, because the success or failure of the transportation program depends on them. And believe it or not, although it's exciting applying some of the technology that we developed in the last decade to transportation, kind of fun. One of the biggest problems in applying technology is to keep a bunch of newcomers from reinventing some of the technology we already had. One of the biggest jobs is to say, don't just keep inventing new fancy gadgets. Help us figure out the clever way to use the ones we've already got. Now, all at once, this sounds depressing and exciting. It's depressing to the inventor who'd like to throw away everything we did in the last 10 years and invent a bunch of new stuff. It's exciting to the person that thinks a little bit deeper and says what the real problem is to improve transportation. We know how to make new exotic materials. We know how to make microwave communication links. We know how to do all kinds of things. But the job of figuring out what you need, when you need it, how you need it, and systems engineering in the real sense of the word, not this hogwash that too many marketing people yacked about for 15 years, where they use the word system engineering roughly equivalent to systematic thought, but real systems engineering, where you figure out the effect of changing various parts of the system on the result. The job of transportation is the biggest systems engineering we were ever faced with, real systems engineering. The gadgetry that's associated with it at the moment is relatively simple. So comparing these two things, transportation has an exceedingly difficult goal to define, almost impossible, but we're going to make it possible. The technology to do all kinds of things is here and available. What it takes is some wise people to select the right technology and put it in the right place and convince enough people that they should do that so that the project will move forward. It's probably a good place to stop and ask for some questions.
This ends side one of this cassette program. To continue, stop the machine, turn the cassette over, and you should be correctly cued for side two.